You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
Welcome to The Fabulous Invalid, Broadway's podcast where we present essential conversations with a curated roster of the best, most important, and innovative theater makers working today, from actors to writers, directors, designers, and everyone in between. We took our name from the title of a 1938 play by Kaufman and Hart that has since become a loving nickname for Broadway itself, always deemed on the verge of decline yet always bouncing back, The Fabulous Invalid. I'm theater savant Jamie Dumont.
And I'm Rob Russo, writer and theater critic with Stage Left at NYC and Stage Left, the podcast.
Hi, Rob.
Hi, Jamie.
Summer bonus episode.
Yeah, we're really doing it.
We are. Well, as you know, in the summer of 2019, which feels like a million years ago, it really does. It's kind of insane. But time's a flat circle, as you always say. We made our first visit to the Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival at Basketball House and Gardens in Garrison, New York. Suffice it to say, we were quite smitten by the company, its mission, and that gorgeous site overlooking the Hudson River.
Yes. So as theater returns, we couldn't resist making another trek about an hour north of New York City to check back in with the Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival's artistic director, Davis McCallum. So up next, you'll hear our recent conversation with Davis about what it's been like leading a theater company through a global pandemic, what shows they've got playing this summer, and some exciting news about the future of the company.
Yes. And I will just preface all of this by saying Davis was very lovely to make some time for us. We did it on the lawn. You might hear picnickers in the background. You might hear a dog barking. There's a lovely couple that stumbled upon us. They seemed a little startled by what we were doing. So you may hear them. But what you get to hear is Davis McCallum. And he's going to give us an update on all things Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival. And then after that, you can hear our episode-long feature on the company from 2019, which is not only a nice walk down memory lane, but it also turned out to be really prophetic in many ways and is just a love letter to regional theater and a company that we adore. So enjoy. Davis, thank you so much for joining us. We are so delighted to be back here again. Yes. As we learned from our last conversation, although your shows are presented in the summer, Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival is a year-round endeavor between your educational programming and planning and pre-production. So what has the last 18 months been like leading this company through a global pandemic?
Well, first of all, thank you, Jamie and Rob, for making the trip and for coming to see tonight's performance. And that's a big question. And it feels like it had several chapters. I mean, we spent the first several months hoping that we could perform in 2020 because of our open air tent and scenario planning. Oh, maybe we'll just do two shows instead of three, or maybe we'll just do one show, or maybe we could tape it and, you know, the actors could get together even if we couldn't welcome the audience. And then we ultimately had to make the kind of heartbreaking decision to cancel the whole season. And we did what a lot of theaters did. We pivoted to digital programming and did some stuff we were really proud of. Then we started to set our sights on 2021 because we thought, you know, as the vaccination started to roll out, that we might be in the position to be one of the first theaters back to live performance this year. And so we announced a season in the winter, kind of with all cautious optimism. And then we started rehearsal with a fully vaccinated company about almost 8 weeks ago now. It felt like a momentous occasion, like stepping over the threshold into rehearsing for the first time. And, you know, the bravery of the artists who had signed up, you know, with in all good faith to go back to performing, and would the audience be masked and would there be social distancing and what equity would allow in terms of performance protocols. And we just kind of navigated through it as a group, really. And so we're thrilled that we're at this moment of being able to welcome audiences back. We're taping this on Friday, I guess the 15th, is it?
Yes.
And
16th.
16th. And, you know, so by the time listeners hear this, the protocols may have changed again. I mean, there are theaters in California that are now going back to requiring masks in the theater. And we really, if anything, we've learned to just kind of keep our knees bent and hold on to each other. And we did a lot of thinking about how we could come back differently in a way that felt more equitable, more inclusive, and kind of more transparent for the whole group who's working on the play. And I think that's held us in really good stead as, you know, the unexpected, you know, kind of unavoidably comes to us. Mm. And then the second, you know, the second whole chapter of that story is we announced last summer that we're the recipient of this incredible gift of 98 acres in Garrison. So we're in the process of planning kind of from the ground up a new future for the Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival, no longer a seasonal tenant here at Boscobel, but as a year-round cultural anchor for the Hudson Valley. And what does that mean?
Right.
Particularly in this moment in 2021. So that's taken up a lot of our time and focus too. Although I have to say it's been a real gift. I mean, literally it's a gift, but also it's been a real blessing to have a kind of bright future to navigate the theater towards over the last 18 months.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it must have been very inspiring to keep you going, right? On those days when you were like, oh my gosh, are we ever gonna get back under the tent?
Yeah.
Right? To know that you had a future that you could be planning, you know, even beyond this season, right?
Yes.
Well, it's also, you're going from basically Memorial Day to Labor Day to year round, right? Isn't that the goal of when you make the move? You'll not just be seasonal, it'll be all seasons?
That's right. I mean, that's the eventual goal. I mean, one of the first questions we had to ask is, in this new home, are we still gonna perform under an open air tent, or are we gonna build a theater, mm-hmm. an indoor theater? Right. And we had some soul searching about it. We decided, look, we love performing in a tent. It's one of the things that truly distinguishes us. But we want to perform in a tent that doesn't have to go up and come down every year.
Right.
And that will be optimized as a place for making and enjoying theater. So that means that we'll perform from, you know, early June, when we do now, into mid-October and close around Indigenous Peoples Day. Mm-hmm. And that'll be an extra 7 weeks of the season in the beautiful Hudson Valley fall when it's a little cooler under the tent. It's kind of hot and steamy night tonight.
Yeah, right.
And we're really looking forward to that. In the long term, we envision adding a second, smaller indoor theater, but that'll be many years off.
That's great. Very exciting. Wow. Yeah. I guess the extra 7 weeks will present new weather challenges that you haven't come across.
That's right. I mean, we like to say that, you know, the elements are kind of an extra character in the play at the Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival, and the folks who really thrive under the tent always find a way to make the unexpected part of the show. And it's the same at the Delacorte. It's one of the great gifts of outdoor theater, The witch is singing last midnight when the thunder goes kapow, and everyone thinks, how could they possibly have arranged something more brilliant?
And you're the best stage manager, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But the truth is, almost anything that happens kind of wakes an audience up to the fact that the theater is a live art form and that it's only happening right now between the actors and the audience.
Right.
And that's where the good stuff is, no matter whether you're indoors or outdoors.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
So. But in answer to your question, Jamie, we will have some new weather challenges. And we were talking before we started taping that there are theaters in the West Coast that are dealing with smoke from forest fires and record temperatures in Portland and rainouts at outdoor theaters that are kind of sister theaters around the country. And so we've been doing a lot of thinking about that in terms of our new theater. You know, what does an outdoor theater look like in an era of climate emergency in terms of drainage and ventilation and safety? So we're looking forward to solving those problems when we're in the real meat of the design phase.
Always a new challenge, right?
That's right.
That's the fun of the theater.
That's right.
Well, something you said in our last interview that has stuck with me is how, you know, when you program shows for your season, how you always want to make sure you're not picking a play that the audience will just politely regard, that they'll be a part of the experience. So tonight we're seeing a new play. I hope I get the title right. Please correct me. The Most Spectacularly Lamentable Trial of Ms. Martha Washington.
That's exactly right.
I got it right. Okay, good. So I'm curious, you know, this is a new work that you're presenting, you know, as part of your season alongside, you know, classics as you do. So how did this play, you know, come across your proverbial desk, and what about it, you know, spoke to you then and made you think this would be good for the tent?
Well, I mean, I guess the first thing I should say is it is a contemporary American play, but it's not a brand new play in the sense that it was written in 2014 or 2015. And James has done one addition to the text because, you know, we've all been through a lot since 2015.
Certainly so.
And, you know, the American story is never finished. It is always being written and rewritten. But I want to acknowledge the other theaters that have produced this play before us. And we're not even the first theater in New York State to produce it. The Black Theater Troupe of Upstate New York produced it in 2019. Mm. And it was slated to be performed at Steppenwolf. And I think they were, you know, weeks away from tech when the pandemic, the shutdown happened. But I gravitated to the play because, you know, all of our plays are about the interaction between the players, to use a kind of Shakespearean term, and the audience. And I felt like the audience would be cast more or less in the role of the jury in the trial referenced in the title of the play. And, you know, the Hudson Valley has a lot of revolutionary history, and the kind of mythology around the foundation of America lives pretty strongly here. And I think the play, in a very savvy and theatrical way, in a way that avoids sanctimony, is really interrogating that mythology and saying, well, wait a minute, let's actually think about what is built into the foundation of America. And the real drama of the question is, will Martha Washington acknowledge her role in the structural racism in America's founding? And that feels like a very present tense question. It doesn't feel like a historical drama to me. It feels like a drama that lives vividly in 2021.
You started this summer season with an audio play of Macbeth, and you usually have two other shows, the one we just discussed, and then, of course, you have The Tempest. So I'm curious, how did you come to picking The Tempest? And you were working in rep, and now you're doing a more linear structure. How did that whole process come about of making the shift? Was that COVID related? Was it just, was there anything that went into that decision?
Sure. Well, you know, it's our last season at Boscobel after 35 years. Mm. And there's something about The Tempest. I mean, I don't know if I truly buy into the Shakespearean biography that, you know, Prospero is sometimes analogous to Shakespeare, and his farewell kind of feels like Shakespeare's farewell to the stage. I'm not sure whether that holds much water, really.
It's a good story, but...
But there is a kind of air of farewell to the play, and it's very wound up in time and the kind of past coming to the present. So it felt like an appropriate way to kind of mark the end of a chapter at Boscobel and a kind of anticipation of a new chapter. So just when I closed my eyes and thought, like, what's a Shakespeare play that speaks to this moment in our organization's history, I kept coming back to the Tempest. And often, you know, we end up choosing plays for a multitude of reasons, and then later we discover the relationships between and among them, particularly in rep. And, you know, there are questions of freedom and bondage, of time and history and family, of accountability and forgiveness that are built into The Tempest that echo in this really interesting way with James's play. Mm. So we were excited about that as well. And then to the question of, like, why are we producing these plays serially this year rather than in rotating rep? I think it was a COVID-related decision. When we were planning the calendar, we thought, look, if we have to shut down and we're in the middle of producing three plays, that for logistical reasons as well as financial reasons just could be a really risky proposition. And we didn't know kind of how much of a risk it would be when we were making the calendar and the budget. We also decided to produce both plays without intermission. Because at the time, that was a real challenge too. Like, when everyone's gathered around the concession stand or when people are in line for the bathroom, those are the riskiest moments from a health perspective.
Right.
So we decided to do them one at a time and without intermission, and thought, look, let's just prioritize safely getting up two shows that we're very proud of. And so that was what we kind of organized our season around.
you know, I think the nature of your repertory program is one of the most exciting things about this theater. So I look forward to in the future that returning with, you know, completely understanding why, you know, yeah. why it might not have been possible.
Me too. I feel that way too. I mean, it's colossally inefficient and expensive and a pain,
right.
but it's also so wonderful. Yeah. To be able to see the same actors in a play, you know, one night and then in a completely different mm-hmm. world the next night. And, you know, we're still crossing over the casting. Five of the actors who are in the first play are also in the second play. And they still have that experience of rehearsing with one director in the afternoon and then coming and performing a different play at night, which is such a wonderful workout.
It's a tradition
for an actor's
too,
imagination.
Right?
Yeah.
yeah, you know. Well, before we get to our picnic on the lawn, which we are very excited for, to be here at our last season of basketball, what would you say to a theater goer who is maybe skeptical about getting back to the theater in this moment? What's your, you know, sort of advice or you know, suggestion to them as to how to get back into the rhythm of theater going as we all sort of navigate this very new terrain for us all.
Yeah, God, it's such a wonderful question, Rob. I mean, I think everybody has their own sense of their level of comfort, and I think people shouldn't come back until they feel like they're ready. But I do feel like sometimes our anxieties mask our desires, you know? You guys just met my son, who's 10 years old, who when he was really little was terrified of dogs. And we knew that that meant that he desperately loved dogs, that he wanted a dog more than anything. Right. And I kind of feel that way about the return to the theater, that the sense of the energy of congregation, of communion with other people, is the thing, that was what was so kind of heartbreaking about watching all of the theaters around the country cancel this season last year. Is the thing that we love, that's kind of the lifeblood of theater, is in many we are one, kind of. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing that was actually the most dangerous. Breathing each other air, conspiring together, right. was a dangerous act. Mm-hmm. And yet I also think it's a sustaining and healing act. And so at the point when, you know, people have made the decision to be vaccinated, and they feel that they're ready to take that step, I wish for them, you know, that it's this restorative act and reminds us that we're connected to each other. That's one of the great functions of the theater. And I feel like when you're doing plays outdoors, that's kind of more palpable than ever.
Yeah. Well, especially after everyone being locked inside for so long,
exactly.
to be able to have these two things together is, it's very healing, very restorative.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. I wish that to be the case. And I invite anybody who's listening to your show to come and join us. We're running until September 4th.
Great.
Our final season here at Basketball. And we want to, you know, invite everyone and share that experience with them. And then we'll invite them to our new home in 2022.
Amazing. Very exciting. Excellent.
Thank you.
Well, thank
you.
So much.
Yes.
Thanks to both of you guys. We're really grateful you're here.
It's the last midnight. It's the last verse. Now before it's past midnight, I'm leaving you my last curse. I'm leaving you alone. You can tend the garden, it's yours, separate and alone. Everybody down on all fours. All right, mother, when? Lost the beans again. Punish me the way you did then. Give me claws and a hunt. Just away from this bunch. And the gloom, and the doom, and the boom.
Welcome to The Fabulous Invalid, a Broadway-centric podcast where we take a 360-degree view at the business of Broadway through interviews with actors, writers, directors, designers, and everyone in between. I'm Jamie Dumont, recovering Broadway marketing associate, personal chef, and event planner.
And I'm Rob Russo, writer and theater critic with Stage Left at NYC.
Hi, Rob.
Hi, Jamie.
Well, here we are. Tonight, we're actually doing something a little different for
us. Yes, and now for something completely different.
Absolutely. Oh, a Monty Python reference.
Yeah, I know my Monty Python.
You surprise me every day.
Well,
but we're coming to you, we're actually
Today we're bringing you a special summer bonus edition of The Fabulous Invalid. We're coming to you from the grounds of Bosco Bell House and Gardens, which for the last three decades has been home to the Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival.
Yes, and I wish everyone who's listening to this podcast could be with us right now, because I am currently looking out at a great lawn that is truly great, that overlooks the Hudson River, and there's some hills in the distance, and West Point. It is a beautiful, sunny, you know, 80-degree summer day here, and it's absolutely astonishing.
And no exaggeration to say that a little bit ago, we were hearing ammunition go off.
Yeah, that's right.
From
some sort of explosion across the river. I don't know what that was.
I believe you said they're blowing stuff up.
Yeah, I think I did. So last night, Jamie and I came to see Much Ado About Nothing under the tent that they have here on the grounds where the Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival performs. And tonight we're seeing Into the Woods, which is the first musical that they've ever produced in their 30-plus years of producing shows here. And this is a really, really, really special place that we experienced together last night for the first time, and will again tonight, and encourage all of you listening, if you have any interest, to get your butt up here before the season's over, because there's nothing like it.
It's very easy to do.
That too.
You get on a train, it's an hour 15, they have a shuttle, but I have to say, I am hooked. I will come back again and again and again.
Oh, for sure.
It's a very special place.
Absolutely. And I have to say, you know, we're seeing Into the Woods tonight. This is my fourth Into the Woods of 2019.
That it is.
Which, yeah, I'm a glutton for punishment, but when it's Into the Woods, is it really punishment?
Should you really say you're a glutton for punishment when
I am.
It comes to Into the
well,
Woods?
Well, exactly.
Well,
right,
some were less punishing than others. Well, this will be our third
our
together.
Third together, that's
and then
right.
You cheated on me once and saw another production.
That's right.
Not far from here,
yeah, Barrington
actually.
Stage up in Massachusetts, yeah, which was...
But
quite
it's,
fun.
You know, it's, I think everybody listening knows Into the Woods, so we don't have to talk about it too much, but it is one of those shows that literally can be done in a variety of different ways.
Yes.
And it's an extraordinary piece of theater.
Mm-hmm. And much like the works of Shakespeare, there's no real, you know, there's a roadmap, but you can do anything with it, right? You can take the words and you can set it anywhere. You can do anything with the story. And so I'm excited to see what they do with Into the Woods tonight.
Yeah, because I think it's going to be a little different than what we've seen previously this
sure.
year.
You know, first and foremost, because we're going to be under a tent out in nature. I'm literally looking at some woods right now off to my side.
And you know those will be utilized.
Oh, yes. They were last night.
Yep. Which is, and they were lit beautifully.
Yeah, something that's really cool about the way they use the space. It's a very intimate space, about 550 seats in the theater. And it's basically, it's like a circus tent. They perform on a sandy stage floor. There's no deck. And every entrance and exit possible is used throughout the production, much like seeing something at the Delacorte, but in Central Park, but much more intimate.
It's an elegant circus, Ted. I feel like it was designed specifically for the festival.
That's right.
And it is architecturally quite beautiful for a tent.
Yes, exactly. For a tent. Perfect. Well, we're going to be sitting down with three different folks, who are associated with the Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival.
Kayla Coleman, an actress.
Yes.
And a student.
Yes.
Here. And Sean McNall, who is the Associate Artistic Director and also the Director of Education. And then, of course, the man himself, Davis McCallum, who is the Artistic Director.
Fabulous.
Of the festival.
Well, shall we get to our interviews?
We shall.
Let's do it. Right now, we are joined by Kayla Coleman, who can be seen as Ursula and C. Cole in Much Ado About Nothing, and as Little Red in Into the Woods. Kayla, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Hey!
Hi!
Now, we know you need to go prepare for Into the Woods tonight, so mm-hmm. we're going to keep this brief, but we
no
are
worries.
Very, very excited to see the show tonight, as we were just talking about before we got started. To dive into questions, you just graduated from NYU, Tish, last year.
Yes,
we
know all the facts!
Oh, yes, we've done our research. We've done our research.
Oh, my!
And this is your first show at the Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival. Can you tell us a bit about your experience here?
Yeah, so this is my first season here.
Season.
And I'm part of the conservatory company, which means I'm in an ensemble of five other people who are pretty early in their career, mm-hmm. young folks who are getting started in the business, some recent graduates, some people who've done graduate school, and like all paths have led to here. Mm-hmm. And it was a rigorous audition process for a lot of us. And we were basically chosen to be part of the whole season. So we are in Much Ado About Nothing as cast, in Cymbeline as cast, and most of us have like lead roles, principal roles, and named roles in Into the Woods.
Wow.
Which is really exciting.
Yeah. How did you come to the festival? How did you hear about it?
So I didn't know jack about the festival. I never heard of it until the casting director, Stephanie Clapper, she called me in, like, I think it was a Thursday night I got the email. Thursday, like, late evening I got the email for an appointment on Friday. And that's the thing they don't train you
right.
in school. They don't tell you, you don't get 3 days to prepare for an audition. You don't get that. That's a luxury.
Right.
Like, you're lucky if you get 48 hours, 24 hours. So she called me in. And I'm looking through this email, and it was like, these sides, these songs from the show have a Shakespearean monologue, contemporary monologue. If you have an instrument, bring it. And I was like, okay.
What's your instrument?
I play the flute.
Okay.
Oh. Yeah.
Did you play the flute in your audition?
I did, too. I did have to play.
Do you know what song you played?
I played... Was it Amazing Grace I played on the flute, I believe?
I've never heard that on the flute. I bet it sounds good.
Yeah, I think I played Amazing Grace. And they put me through the ringer. Everything they said to do, I did.
Right. Yeah. Well, it seems like it was a good preparation for the summer.
Yeah.
It was a nice entree into what this was going to be.
And I'm
like,
the
right?
type of person, if you say you're going to do all those things, I'm going to believe you. I'm going to take it at face value.
Right.
And I'm going to come up with mm-hmm. all those things prepared.
Yep. So what have you learned now from your experience at Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival? Or are you still learning?
Oh, I'm still deep in the process.
Yeah.
I think something that is really heavily like on my mind, at the forefront of my mind right now, is preservation. Preserving the body, preserving stamina, rigor, learning how to pace myself. At a certain point, we were doing 3 shows, and now we're doing 2. And we were rehearsing 2, rehearsing 1, running 2. It gets confusing at a certain point.
You're just kind of whizzing around.
Right, you're whizzing around. So you have to learn how to calibrate your energy and your body and listening to your body, listening to your mind, getting the rest. And my teachers, they were not playing in class and they were like, you know, put on those knee pads. Like, you need these for the rest of your life. This
right.
is not just for this moment in time. And you have to make sure you are taking care of yourself. And that's so important. The self-care is really important. That's what I'm realizing. I've already got a couple bumps and bruises. And now I'm like, okay, we got to let them heal.
Let's talk about that for a second. Because I think some of our audience don't know that you're working on a stage that's basically sand.
We're working in a sandbox. We're literally on the playground.
Yeah.
We're on the playground. It's an adult playground. That's what it is. And the shows are very interactive. If you've never seen a show here. In Much Ado, I'm very much so climbing things, running through the aisles in between seats and things like that. You'll see tonight in Into the Woods, and listeners, you'll see if you come. We are taking all the exits. We're using the woods. We're using the beautiful Belvedere. Like, you can see West Point from the theater. We're using all the most imaginative ways to make this thing come alive. We are in the woods doing it.
Yeah. You're not mic'd, right?
We are mic'd for this.
Oh, you're mic'd? Okay, so you weren't mic'd for Much Ado.
We're never mic'd for the Shakespeare's.
Oh, I love that.
But we are mic'd, and that adds a really nice touch to the shows as well. It's kind of daunting at first, and you're like, what do you mean I'm not mic'd? And there's 600 people in the audience every night? Okay, how is this going to work?
Right.
But you calibrate, you get used to the tent and what it feels like to speak. And then you get all that good voice and speech training you got.
Exactly.
You put it to use.
It
comes into play. Right. And this is not my first time performing outside. Mm. I did Big River in front of a river in Massachusetts. 2 years, was it 2 years? Almost 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago.
Talk about a perfect site-specific.
Right? Yeah. Site-specific in front of a waterfall.
Oh, wow. Gosh.
In the middle of Sturbridge, Massachusetts.
Cool.
And we were mic'd there, but mics only project what you are giving.
That's right.
So clarity is important, and clarity is always more important than volume. If you're clear, then that's what, because you're going to be conveying the story. That's what's important.
And you can't predict the elements. I mean, I can hear the train going in the background right now. There's
always a train going.
Yeah.
There's always a midnight train to Georgia hopping over there. And it's great how you have to incorporate that stuff into the
right.
show.
Yeah. Yeah.
For opening night for Woods, oh my gosh, we had the best weather possible. It was thunderstorming.
Oh, God, that's perfect.
And I believe that's the best way to do Into the Woods. It got dark exactly when the story got dark. And when the story gets real, the weather got real. And I believe in God. I believe in a higher power, and all things are working on my side at all times. And so it was lightning crackling right when the witch was exiting. Children will listen. We were all coming forward in the rain with umbrellas. When the giant's footsteps were going, we heard some thunder happening.
Perfect.
You had the best collaborator possible.
When the baker up and left the group, we hear the giant's footsteps of the thunder going, and me, Cinderella, and Jack, we all looking at each other and running in the rain. And so it can only, if you have an open heart and an open vessel, it can only add to the experience. So for me, that's how I interpret it. Whenever I heard the thunder, I was like, we don't know where the giant is. The giant's over there. The giant's behind us. The giant's in front of me. I don't know where she is. I don't know where she is. It can only add to my experience as Red, if that makes sense. But I think this show also suits itself to this space, because if it's a beautiful day and it's sunny and it's 75, it's a great show.
Right.
If it's thunderstorming, it's a great show. If it's cloudy, it's a good show.
Yeah. Which is the mark of a good show.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, we want to let you go and get ready for this great show, but I have a question, because I did stalk you on social media a
Jamie's
little bit.
Signature move.
Which I love to do.
What is your question?
Well, my question is, on one of your social medias,
Instagram,
you call yourself an artistic disruptor, and I love that term, and I want to know what that means to you.
Artist is my profession, but being a artistic disruptor is my calling and like my life mission, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
And so how do I make those two coincide? That's always what I'm looking to think about. And there are places and people who are doing those constantly. And I try to affiliate myself with those places, and those places that do that spiritual, hard, deep work and critique and look at how we come to our art and whose voices aren't being heard and who we're not listening to and what stories aren't being told, and also the dynamics of just any theater company, who's in positions of power, how do we make everyone a part of the table, or forget that, how do we build a new table?
Right.
Okay, because some tables are old and rickety and we don't need to sit at them.
Right.
And I may not necessarily want to sit at them. So when I say I'm an artistic disruptor, that means I'm here to disrupt the practices that have been rewarding some and not others. And how do I make it an equal playing field? And not only an equal one, but an equitable one for everybody as well. Sometimes we have to throw stuff away and start from scratch. And that's okay. Because who is it serving? If it's not serving everyone, if it's not serving me and the people that I come from in my community, then that's a problem. And who are we doing for? If we're doing something for the greater good and we're trying to reach the widest audience, then let's hold ourselves accountable, and I'm going to hold myself accountable and everyone else accountable to find a solution to do that.
Right.
And to do that work. And that's not easy work. And those are hard conversations to have, but they need to be had. It's small changes. The way we talk about things, I think there are power in our words.
Absolutely.
There's power in our words. And words mean a lot. And that's why I'm very intentional with the words I choose. And that's how I approach being an artistic disruptor. It starts with the day-to-day interactions.
You know who I think is a disruptor as well? Little Red.
Oh, heck yeah.
In her own way.
I mean,
that was good casting.
She's one of the bravest people. Red has some strength. She has bite.
Yeah, does have bite. Well, we look forward to seeing your bite and your Red tonight.
Thank you
for joining us.
Disruptions.
Yes.
Yes. Please.
All right. Please. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And I know things now, many valuable things that I hadn't known before. Do not put your faith in a cape and a hood. They will not protect you the way that they should. And take extra care with strangers. Even flowers have their dangers. And though scary is exciting, nice is different than good. Now I know, don't be scared. Granny is right, just be prepared. Isn't it nice to know a lot? And a little bit not.
Sean McNall is the Associate Artistic Director and Director of Education at Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival, and he also plays Don Pedro in Much Ado About Nothing, which we saw last night.
Mm-hmm.
welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming down.
Glad to have you on.
So I'm curious because you also do you're the director of education here, mm-hmm. and education plays a very large part in what you guys do at the Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival. Your website is excellent. I read the full script of Much Ado About Nothing, not to mention your dramaturgy PDF, which was outstanding. Can you talk a little bit more about the education programs at the festival and why they're important?
Well, we can start, I guess, with the summer because it's there are three basic domains that exist in the education world. During the summer, most of our programs are sort of pre-professional programs for interns and for actors. In fact, several of the actors you saw last night and many that you'll see tonight are non-union actors who are here on an education basis. Kayla, who you were just speaking to just now, for instance, is a member of our conservatory company. And we really celebrate that liminal space, but for actors who are just on the verge, I think, of getting their card and are looking to get as many reps as possible here under the guidance and with the mentorship of our actors here. And that's the same for our intern program as well. A lot of interns are running many of the things you see going on under the tent right now as you speak, which is not uncommon in these kinds of scenarios. I would say that what is uncommon is that whereas I think some programs are pretty eager to put their interns and their actors to work in any capacity possible, myself having been to Actors Theatre of Louisville and loved it in the 90s, but I spent a lot more time removing nails from boards than I did actually on the boards themselves. We pride ourselves in trying to provide a kind of, you know, graduate level experience with real roles that they can really sink their teeth into. So that means that we spend a good portion of the year looking for these very particular actors that we can sort of train and in one way or another rise to the level of the actors we have under our tent. Many times often exceeded by their enthusiasm and their ability and our surprise that we're in their shadow. But that's okay. That's how it's supposed to be. That's the way it works. And we also, during the summer, have a host of community-driven programs that are education-oriented, but we put sort of more emphasis on the fun. So, for instance, I just ended a two-week Shakespeare summer camp that we do with kids in the community, and they're all from around the sort of tri-state area.
What age is that?
Well, we have three different groups. One is 8 to 11, and then 11 to sort of the verge of being talented young high school students, and then the high school students. And that's really geared towards bringing in people who are curious about the theater but maybe a little bit more academic or bookish, would like to be in the spotlight but don't necessarily want to go do Matilda or don't feel like that's, you know, they would love to, but that's just really not what they do or that's what they feel most comfortable in. So it becomes this interesting little niche where people get to express themselves in a way and sort of delight their parents because it feels academic and it feels like it's Shakespeare, but at the same time, it's, you know, it's them being irreverent and fun at the same time. So, and we also do professional development programs, which means that we have a very core set of practices that we do throughout the school year. It's a rehearsal room pedagogy, which means that we treat the plays, whatever it is we're teaching in the school, with the same sensibilities that an actor or a director or a playwright would. We push the desks aside, we get up on our feet, and it's a high engagement activity. We do our best to avoid just simply reading the text. So we do professional development programs throughout the summer, which is onboarding a lot of the teachers that we work with throughout the school year so they understand what they should expect when our teaching artists come in. Somewhere around September is about the time our full education program begins, and that's about a 20-person team. Most of the people are themselves actors or directors or playwrights. They all live in New York City. We do a bulk of our training in New York City. That is their point of departure. And throughout the year, throughout the tri-state area, we have our teaching artists working anywhere from 1 to 5 days in a host of up to 50 schools in any particular school year, from as, you know, far south as the far Rockaways, far north as we get as far north as Rhinebeck, I guess, at one given time or another. So it's quite a big scope. And, you know, we teach those plays that you'd expect us to teach, those six that are in the curriculum, in addition to also producing a touring production every year. We just finished Julius Caesar. It's going to be concluding its run under the tent tomorrow afternoon.
And where was that before? Where does that tour? All in the same area?
Well, now that will tour. It's cast and rehearsed in New York City for about 3 weeks. The point of departure is in New York City. Every day at about 4 a.m., they all get into a bus and they make the large migration to Newburgh. We're heavily grant funded in Westchester, so we serve a lot of schools in the Westchester County, which is proximate and good for them as well. It's about 60-40 grant funded and people and schools that pay for it outright out of their pocket one way or another. We reach anywhere between 40 and 55 8,000 students and teachers.
Wow.
Any
that's huge. I'm just blown away by the scope of this program. Like, oh my gosh.
Well, it's I will say that before I came here, I've been here 5 years. I've been here when Davis came up as the artistic director. We were old friends, and the first time we met was actually doing Julius Caesar. The last time they did it in the park, I just graduated from Juilliard. He was a directing assistant. I came in and played Augustus Caesar, and you know, we've been friends ever since. I went on to work at the Pearl Theater Company for several years, and that was sort of my home for about 12 years. Davis came up here, he brought me up, and I inherited a really robust program. I was very fortunate. I knew the gentleman who ran it before, Chris Edwards, and we fortunately had worked together and had very similar points of view on how these programs could and should be successful. And it's largely based on the good work that had been laid for those 15 or so years. I sort of built on top of that, and we're sort of keeping the good conversation going.
I love that you go into the schools and you teach the teachers what to expect.
Yes.
Because that, to me, says that you're really getting in the foundation, right?
Yeah.
Because the teachers don't know what you're doing or what you're trying to accomplish. It's going to make it harder for you guys to get through to the students.
Yeah, and you'd be... Because pedagogy and the teaching differs over time, our younger teachers, I think, are a little bit more accustomed to sort of high engagement learning in one way or another. So they're a little bit easier to incorporate and really get physical. But it doesn't. What's wonderful about it is, it's also we're teaching the teachers how they should be the best students in the classroom once we actually arrive, so that they know that we expect you to be in there and to be modeling for your students, because they're going to be looking to you to be foolish, because a lot of what we're asking them to do is go out, play the fool, take a big risk, be bold like an actor would, and discover, you know, the text in your body so that you can learn to love the plays and realize that, you know, humanity's been the same since.
Right. It's interesting that it's hard to get kids to play the fool.
Yes.
But I guess Shakespeare's scary for everyone. But it shouldn't be.
It shouldn't be.
And that's probably one of the main things that you try to teach everybody.
Absolutely. I would say that I came to it similarly. I would say I was attracted to Shakespeare initially as a kid because of the level of difficulty in one way or another. There was something attractive about, well, if I'm going to be an actor, I want to do the hardest thing. And if I can do the hardest thing, I can do the easiest thing. But I quickly realized that what was hard and strange about it was really, it was a mistake in how, in one way or another, I engaged for the first time. I remember so vividly sitting in a classroom, middle school, reading Julius Caesar aloud, and being embarrassed to hear my own voice speaking the words among my peers, because there was a sort of a liturgical quality to it. Like, here we are doing this terrible thing that we don't understand it, we don't care about it, and you're making me pretend like I'm wearing a toga, which is embarrassing. Sorry, it was particularly in the 80s and 90s, but less so now. Now you might see a toga in school.
Right,
it's wonderful.
Exactly. Yeah.
My God. But then I quickly realized that, you know, people have always been the same, and that much of what we think of when we think of storytelling and indeed human being was in some ways first breathed into life in Shakespeare and first became the popularization of the human being first came in. And that's through everything that's included, the high and the low, the fools, the sex, the violence, everything that we love about entertainment was very much there. And he was playing to the same interests and the same ideas that we are now. And to reveal that to a young audience or an old audience is a great privilege, but there's also a kind of giddiness in watching people discover that for themselves the way you did. And you can pass that large conversation on moving forward. And that's what excites me the most about it, is seeing the lights turn on in someone's head and when they're doing something like Macbeth, and understanding that the same ambitions, the same potential for making bad choices, as it were, sort of exists in them, and they see it all around them, and that they can learn a little bit or project a little bit of their own experience on these characters that seem otherwise so remote.
Right.
Right.
It's very gratifying.
Yes, it is. Oh, it's wonderfully gratifying.
Glenda Jackson calls Shakespeare the most contemporary writer today.
I would think so.
I mean, I love thinking about it.
We live in extreme. We live in extremes, and if he didn't do anything, it was he wrote extremes.
That's for sure. How do you balance your role as both administrator in the company and an actor?
Yeah, it's complicated. I mean, it's wonderful from September through April when I'm only in the office 9 to 5. I have a 6-year-old son and a wife, and this decision was largely made so I could be a father proper. But Davis was really keen, because I'm the associate artistic director, not to bring a person whose eye was necessarily geared towards directing.
Right.
I do a lot of leading from within. I'm a kind of, he describes me as an ombudsman, largely do conflict resolution and try to make sure that everyone kind of understands best practices and that everyone knows that there's someone that's deeply concerned about their experience here.
There's conflict with actors?
Well, yes. I mean, you can look around. It's not only the interpersonal conflict, but it's also just we're at odds with the elements here.
Yeah.
And it's understanding and having a sense of the rhythm of producing under this tent and making sure that people can anticipate what's coming. And once we're in the midst of something that seems uncontrollable and chaotic, that it's okay and we can be successful in spite of that or, you know, because of it in some ways. But it does get tricky. I mean, one of the things that when I came up, I sort of joked with Kayla. I said I was just in your neck of the woods. It was one of those situations in which I needed to go and address some things that have been bubbling up and help some people come to terms with where they are on this evening that they're going to be doing a show. And that's a privilege. I get to be the human and portray the human at the same time. I would say it's probably more complicated for those that are my peers.
Right.
Because I try to go to great lengths to let them know that, you know, I'm not the Stasi. I'm not just spying on you. You know,
right.
I'm committed to your experience here. Right. And if nothing else, I'm just, when something happens, it reverberates through me like a bell, and people that need to hear it do. And then we can do something about it to make their experience, you know, everything they need it to be. But it is complicated, for sure.
Well, they're a lucky company to have you.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sean, for chatting with us.
Thank you so much.
We're loving our experience up here. Yeah. And thank you for giving us a little bit more insight.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Why you do what you do, that's the point. All the rest of it is chatter.
Look at her, she's crying.
If the thing you do is pure in intent, if it's meant and it's just a little bent, does it matter?
Yes.
No, what matters is that everyone tells tiny lies. What's important really is the size. Only three more tries and we'll have our prize. When the end's in sight, you'll realize if the end is right, it justifies the beat.
We are delighted to introduce Davis McCallum, the artistic director of Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival. Davis, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for making the trip.
Oh, of course.
You took over the role of artistic director from the festival's founder.
I did.
Terry O'Brien. So what was it like stepping into the shoes of someone who had created the company and then now leading it into the future?
Well, Terry ran it for 27 years.
Wow.
And so his artistic, you know, fingerprints are all over our kind of house style of the way we produce Shakespeare and what our audience comes to expect and the whole experience when they come to this place. And I think luckily I felt like my approach was very aligned with his, and I was, you know, honored to really kind of carry forward the legacy that he had started. Like you guys were saying, I had only been here once before to see a production of Hamlet, I think in 2013 maybe, or maybe 2012. I was workshopping a new musical at New York Stage and Film in Poughkeepsie. And my friend was playing Hamlet, and I thought, okay, I'll come down and see you play Hamlet. And then a couple years later, when this job came up, I thought, I actually loved going to that theater. I'm interested in that job.
Yeah.
And one of the things I thought could be an advantage for the theater is to really capitalize on the fact that we're just 50 miles from Times Square.
Right.
You know, we're here with this amazing view in this location that feels like it's another world, but... Right. You can get on the train at Grand Central Station and be in Cold Spring in an hour and 15 minutes.
And we just did.
Yeah, we just did. We literally just got off that train.
It is true. Yeah. That's amazing.
That's very easy.
So how do you describe your role as artistic director then?
Well, the most important thing I do is I choose the plays that we're going to produce and I curate the artists that are going to bring those plays to life. And that process happens kind of as soon as we get the first plays of a current season up. I'm thinking about what we're going to be doing next year. And then we normally announce the plays in October and hire designers in the fall and do a bunch of pre-production and cast right before the holidays. And then we do a little more pre-production and produce a really robust program of educational programming in the early spring. And then we start rehearsal in April. So it's a kind of a 12-month cycle that comes around pretty quickly, even though our performances are more or less Memorial Day to Labor Day.
Right. And how did you come to Into the Woods? Because this is Into the Woods is your first musical.
It's true, yes. We did this production of a world premiere of an adaptation of Rip Van Winkle last year.
Okay.
And we did it kind of inspired by the public works shows that they do at the Delacorte at the end of the Shakespeare in the Park season. So we had a huge cast of community members, and we had a live band and an original score, and So it was one of the first times we had heard a band under that tent. And it was during that production that I started to think the kind of conventional wisdom that a musical would never be possible under that tent might not be true.
Yeah.
And so we started to investigate what kind of additions we'd have to make to just the hardware of the tent to make a musical happen. But really, this, I'm so proud of this production of Into the Woods you guys are going to see tonight. And among the things I'm most proud of is the fact that it sounds great. I have a really great musical director, Amanda Morton, and Ken Travis is the sound designer. And together, they've just kind of done a minor miracle because it sounds terrific under an open-air tent.
Yeah, there's a bit, I think, of your Sitz probe on your website.
Yes.
Yes, it does sound fantastic. I can't wait. Does that mean there's a short list of other musicals that may or may not happen in the near future?
A number of artistic...
Make some news for us here?
I know. I'd love to pull in some extra listeners to the Fabulous Invalid podcast with this breaking news.
Yeah.
But I will say that as soon as I programmed it, I thought, a lot of other theaters that, have Shakespeare in their name, in Ashland, Oregon, or Stratford, Ontario, or the Shakespeare Theater in D.C., have started to include the kind of classic, Golden Age American musical theater as part of what we understand a classic to be. But I really was attracted to Woods because it's a musical that really seems like it values language. The lyrics are so important,
and
there's so much book, especially in the second act. Mm-hmm. And so it felt like actors that had a kind of muscle for Shakespeare and could sing the amazing score would be a perfect group to tackle a very actor-driven production of Woods. Mm. And... now I'm just kind of free associating about Woods, but I think it's often produced in a way that feels like it kind of weighs it down, and it's long for a musical, and it takes a bunch of really hairpin turns in terms of tone and story, and that feels kind of like a Shakespeare play. If you have a big set, it can slow it down and kind of enforce a kind of singular tone over the whole show. Mm. And I think a musical like this wants to be hilariously funny and kind of break your heart in the next moment, and you want to have the music and the actors really be able to modulate that.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things I like
about it. You know, the amazing thing about We Saw Much Ado Last Night and just the economy of the staging, right?
Right.
Two benches and, a stairwell, and that was it.
Yeah.
The space is so dynamic, and entrances and exits from every different corner, and I'm sure we'll see that tonight. Because the show calls for it, of course. Well, you touched on something that I wanted to ask you about in particular, which is, expanding beyond the canon of Shakespeare to include other works by more contemporary artists or other classics in your seasons. What is sort of the thought process behind that, and how do you arrive at what more contemporary works in particular to include?
Well, our space is a 530-seat, basically a circus tent,
right.
And there's no deck on the floor.
Right.
The actors are standing right on basically the ground. It's a kind of synthetic, sand ground that they use in
Kayla
horse jumping.
Kayla called it a sandbox.
Sandbox, yeah. As long as you don't call it a kitty litter box.
Right.
So therefore, I'm really excited by plays that feel like it's about the relationship between the actors and the audience, because what do I know about what Shakespeare was really like in, the 17th century? But I feel like those plays work best when the audience is in really spontaneous collaboration with the actors. Mm. So I can sometimes sit in the tent in tech or in a preview, and if I feel like the audience is just kind of regarding the play without feeling like they've been invited to lean forward and really participate in it, then the tent's not actually being utilized.
Right.
They can never disappear the audience in this tent, in part because the show starts at 7:30 and it's in broad daylight.
Right.
But also, kind of energetically, their presence has to be the key thing that unfolds the play. I was listening to you guys talk to Andre de Shields about Hadestown, and I love that show too. And I feel like that sense of a contract with the audience is fundamental to what we're trying to do here as well.
Yeah. Mm. And do you find that when you bring up new directors and it's their first time working in the tent, that there's a little like
history lesson that has to be given, or this is how we use the tent, or do you let them just go on their own and then adjust as needed?
It's a little bit of a mix. I mean, my philosophy is basically you hire really great people and let them do their thing and try and support them to the full extent of what the theater can manage. But also, I think, you know, there are just a couple of little hints about the way, you know, the acoustics in that tent work, or how the pre-show unfolds. And I've kind of made it a rule for myself that when I'm talking to directors about projects in the future, that they just have to come up and see it, you know, because if I have a coffee with a director who's interested in X, Y, or Z production, we'll spend half the coffee me trying to describe this tent.
Right, exactly.
I see the look on their face, just right. Like, I'm not understanding what you're saying. But if they come, then immediately they're like, oh, this thing I was going to pitch you makes no sense because it really needs a set, or maybe we should think about this instead. And I've had the most fruitful conversations that way.
Well, that's what makes this space so special too, right? Is that it is unique. It is its own thing. You have to really come here and see it to really fully appreciate the magic that happens in that tent.
I think you're right.
Yeah. Something else that I really was struck by and really appreciated about your company is the diversity among the members. And I'm wondering how you intentionally go about fostering, you know, or casting a diverse group of actors, and how that sort of fits into the mission overall of Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival.
Well, it's one of our core values is inclusion, and that's kind of based around the idea that the tent is an inclusive space. I mean, it doesn't have walls. It's right. A place where we, you know, that phrase that, you know, the Democratic Party, you know, like, let's have it be a big tent. You know, and what we have is a big tent.
Comes from somewhere,
you know?
Right? Yeah.
And, I think that the origin of that is that sense that we're all in it together. And so we do feel like it's important to put on stage and backstage, and for the people who are leading the projects and designing the shows, that represent the world on stage that reflects the world we all share. Mm-hmm. You know, the audience has gotten more diverse in recent years, and the company's gotten more diverse. There's a state park not too far away from us, near where 301 intersects the Taconic, that has a little beach at the lake there. Mm-hmm. And I love to go there with my family, in part because it's just wildly diverse. It's everybody together on a hot July afternoon trying to get a little bit of cool and jump in the lake. And so in terms of, the theater, I think we'll continue to try and move the theater so that everybody feels that this is a place that belongs to them. Mm. And we think about that when we're programming, and we think about that when we're casting and hiring, too.
Yeah. Well, that's the best way to do it. Yeah. Well, thinking about the future, what would you like to, what is your vision for this company moving forward, say 5 years from now? What would you like to achieve?
Well, it's a great question. You know, we're on the grounds of Boscobel, a historic house museum. And, you know, our theater, if we were here in early April, there'd be nothing but just kind of a gravel patch over there. We kind of come up from zero and down to zero at the end of September. And, you know, 32,000 people see the shows here every summer, which is a large number of people. 77 performances. And I don't know this to be true, but looking across the wider field of the American theater, I can't think of another theater that doesn't have a building, even one that they rent, that has 32,000 people seeing a show.
Right.
So our reach, and I'd like to think our impact, is way above the amount of infrastructure that we actually have. So, you know, I'd love to have a kind of 2.0 of this performance facility that has better bathrooms and a better concession stand for the audience and a much, much better dressing room for our artists and for our wardrobe staff. Jen Thompson, who directed Into the Woods, calls our backstage tent, which it is a tent. She calls it the MASH tent. And I like, if, you know, we're of the same generation and watched MASH on TV, then you know exactly what she means.
Absolutely, yeah. It's both complimentary and also a little bit of a diss.
I took it in the best possible spirit, and then we all laughed about it. But immediately I said, you know, that is a nickname that is going to stick.
Yeah.
It's just so apropos.
That's great.
Oh, my gosh. Cool.
Amazing. Well, Jamie, we always have one question that we ask all of our guests, and I'll have Jamie ask it because he's the best at doing it.
We do ask everyone this, and that is, what was that show or experience that made you want to work in the theater?
My God, what a great question. You know, we're also producing Cyrano this summer, and I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, and there was a theater there, which at the time actually was performing under a tent, the Georgia Shakespeare Festival, which sadly is no more. Mm. And they did this production of Cyrano probably in the late 80s or early 90s, and it was swelteringly hot under that tent. And they had fans that would kind of slowly rotate at the top of the tent. And because it was the late 80s, there was a huge kind of wig and hair design. Oh, sure. I remember the actors, just the wigs just kind of like sticking to their faces. Oh, no. But it was also completely magical. And there's this great actor that was playing Cyrano with a huge prosthetic nose. I'm sure if I could, you know, take a hot tub time machine to 1990 and look at it, I would have all sorts of things to say about it. But at the time, I was just completely transported. Mm. And I went back maybe 3 or 4 times that summer to see that show. And it was something about the magic of language and, you know, on a summer night, and all those people packed into that tent kind of breathing together.
Yeah.
So it's funny how whatever it is that sends you into the theater in the first place, I don't know what the metaphor is, but it's like some from the animal kingdom, some kind of like moment of, oh, that's it.
Yep.
And you end up kind of pursuing that thing, mm-hmm. even subconsciously.
Totally. For the rest of your life.
Well, also other things, hopefully.
Yes. Amazing.
And it's been a full circle moment.
That's right.
I would imagine doing Cyrano. Yeah. This year.
Yeah, it's a great production of Cyrano. We also have an astonishing actor, Jason O'Connell, who's playing Cyrano, and he co-adapted it with his friend Brenda Withers, who, in addition to being a great playwright, is also a wonderful actor. And there are only 5 actors in it, so it really is a kind of celebration of, you know, the kind of creative spirit, the kind of poetic spirit that Cyrano personifies. Funny and also pretty heartbreaking. So you guys saw Much Ado and You're Seeing Woods, so when I persuade you to come back on that train in August, you'll see Cyrano.
Oh, you won't have to work hard at all to persuade us to come back.
Good.
Thank you so much for chatting with us, and we look forward to seeing the show tonight.
Yes,
thanks very much to you guys.
Thank you.
Rob here with You May Be Wondering. Following our conversations with Davis, Sean, and Kayla, you may be wondering more about the history of the Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival itself and how you can come see a show. Well, the Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival, or HVSF, was founded by Melissa Stern and Terry O'Brien in September 1987 with an outdoor production of A Midsummer Night's Dream at Manitoga, the home of industrial designer Russell Wright in Garrison, New York, about an hour or so north of Manhattan. The following year, HVSF staged a production of Shakespeare's As You Like It, under a tent, overlooking the Hudson River on the expansive grounds of Boscobel House and Gardens, an historic neoclassical home named for Boscobel Manor in England that was built by British loyalists between 1804 and 1808, raised in 1955, then rebuilt 15 miles north at its current scenic location in Putnam County. Every summer since, HVSF has grown, adding a second show to their annual summer season in 1994, an annual touring production for local middle and high schools starting in 2004,
a custom-designed open-air theater tent with seating for 540 patrons built in 2006, and a third show to their annual season in 2008. As we mentioned, this summer's production of Into the Woods marks the first musical that HVSF has ever produced. Since 1987, more than 500,000 audience members have seen a production at HVSF. And you can too. Performances of Into the Woods, Cyrano, and Much Ado About Nothing continue until September 8th. And HVSF is accessible to New York City and surrounding areas by car, bus, train, shuttle, or taxi. Just check out their website. They've got all the details there. Of course, HVSF is not the only summer Shakespeare company in America. I'm willing to bet that no matter where you are listening from, there is some form of summer theater nearby, Shakespeare or not, oftentimes free or else very affordable. The most famous, of course, is the public theater's Free Shakespeare in the Park in Central Park in Manhattan, which was founded as the New York Shakespeare Festival by visionary theater pioneer Joe Papp in 1954, and itself started a trend in cities nationwide. Today, the acclaimed Oregon Shakespeare Festival in Ashland offers a robust season of programming, combining new works and classics. The Shakespeare Theater Company in Washington, D.C. offers free summer performances, as does the Chicago Shakespeare in the Parks, Baltimore Shakespeare Festival, Shakespeare on the Common in Boston, Shakespeare Dallas, the Colonial Theater of Rhode Island, Pittsburgh Shakespeare in the Parks, Shakespeare by the Sea in Los Angeles and Orange County, the Portland Actors Ensemble, the Austin Shakespeare Festival, the Kentucky Shakespeare Festival, the Nashville State Shakespeare Festival, the South Dakota Shakespeare Festival, which just started a couple years ago, and the Heart of America Shakespeare Festival in Kansas City, and the list goes on and on. Something quite unique about HVSF, though, is the fact that it is a repertory company, meaning that the same ensemble of actors perform up to three shows simultaneously, rotating on different nights of the week. Yesterday, Jamie and I saw Much Ado About Nothing. Tonight, we see Into the Woods, and tomorrow night, the company will perform Cyrano. In North America, only the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in Ashland and the Stratford and Shaw Festivals in Canada really offer such a traditional repertory programming experience, a delight for audiences and actors alike. Sitting under the tent at HVSF, looking out at the sun setting across the glistening Hudson River, I was reminded that there's nothing like an open-air theater. And there's something really incredibly special about revisiting the plays of Shakespeare, the Elizabethan era, and other classics, many if not most of which were originally performed outside or in open-air venues during the summer. It's no mistake that these companies are often called festivals. There's a sense of occasion, of celebration, of community that is created in such a setting that makes for a memorable and enchanting summer evening. If not this summer, definitely put Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival or another outdoor theater company near you on your radar for next summer. You won't regret it. Jamie here, that's our show. Thanks for listening. You can hear us anytime on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Fabulous Invalid is a production of O&M Etc. and The Fabulous Invalid LLC. Our theme is by Lucky Chops. Today's episode was edited and engineered by Aaron Kaufman. And a very special thank you to Matt Ross PR and everyone at the Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival for being so accommodating. Find us online at thefabulousinvalid.com and on social media at Fabulous Invalid. And be sure to tune in Wednesdays starting in September.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.